Last week I watched, as some of you may have, the pictures that came back from the planet Jupiter. And it was good to see that Purim had reached Jupiter. When those not of our faith visit the synagogue during the reading of the Megillah, they're sometimes nonplussed by the kind of reception, the seemingly irreverent reception which is accorded to the reading of the Book of Esther. If we're in the traditional synagogue, it's a noisy congregation, armed with noisemakers of all kinds, who are determined to drown out with foot stampings and the winding of the Gregors every mention of the arch-fiend Haman. And there's a kind of joyous hand-clapping in the synagogue when Esther and Mordecai undo the arch-villain. Our neighbors are not accustomed to treating any part of the Bible with anything but a solemn hush. In their sanctuaries, the Bible is a large, bound, beautifully tooled folio, which sits apart, alone, high on some pedestal, from which a reader intones in proper tones the reading of the week. Then generally the sermon is a teaching of an explanation of the high moral purpose or the deeper wisdom of the text. Somehow the whole Bible, all 24 books of it, partake of the same symbol, that is, they represent divine inspiration, revelation. And to treat any part of the Bible with less than reverence seems shocking. Our tradition knows an older habit. It remembers a time when the Bible was not a bound volume, but a series of separate scrolls, and where a very different kind of reaction, of attitude, was accorded to each of the scrolls. In our ark, we do not keep the Bible. We keep a Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the five books of Moses. Our word for Bible, Tanakh, suggests the way in we look at the Holy Writ, not as a single writing partaking equally of divinity, but as a series of writings, some of the most profound wisdom, divine in origin in one way or another, others of significance, of meaning, and still others which are simply historical, documentary, or part of the literary traditions of our people. There is a reason for each of the books of the Bible being ultimately in the Tanakh, but not all of the books are there for deep and profound and reverential reasons. And sometimes when we try and find the higher moral purpose of one of these books that is not there for that kind of reason, we misunderstand its whole basis. The Song of Songs, the great collection of love poetry. I can show you in any seminary library shelf upon shelf of explanations of the Song of Songs, theological explanations, the beloved and the lover, God and Israel, the church and the Christ, that there must be some kind of higher symbolism here of the relationship between God and his people. Now, the doctrine of the chosen and the choosing people is an interesting one of significance, but it's not implicit in the Song of Songs. The Song of Songs is nothing more or less than a collection, an anthology of rather short but quite beautiful love poems and marriage songs, which were well known to our people in antiquity, which survived because they were beloved by the people, and which speak not to the doctrine of chosenness, but speak rather to a rather healthy-minded attitude towards the body, towards feelings, towards love, towards pleasure. There are parts of the Bible which are never read liturgically. The Torah is read through annually. All of it is read. All of it is interpreted. Only parts of the prophetic books are read, parts which are apposite to readings of the Torah. The Psalms are part of our liturgy. But the deadly dull chronologies of the priestly historians are passed over in silence. And the book of Esther is read with becoming irreverence. Now why? Because it is irreverent. And despite, again, a whole spate of volumes which find some higher moral purpose in Esther, which describe Esther as that ultimate heroine who proves her loyalty to her people. She's safe in the palace, though Haman has imposed upon the king the order that all Jews are to be killed. Her Jewishness is not known. She is protected by the royal favor. She will survive. She is only to keep silent, but she does not keep silent, and she undoes the evil decree. And so, in one way or another, the theme of loyalty is exposed and expressed in these lectures and essays and sermons. Now again, I have no argument with the theme of religious loyalty, of loyalty to Israel, to the people of Israel. But that's not the theme of the book of Esther. For I suggest to you that to read Esther is to come upon an essentially a-religious book. What sermon can you make out of a book which begins with a chapter-long description of a drunken brawl, a royal bash in the palaces of Shushan of Persia, which lasted for 120 days and 120 nights and is almost described in 120 lines. And then the book of Esther proceeds to something that belongs really on the worst of our television fare, a kind of backstage, backdoor, backstairs description of how models were prepared for a beauty contest in Persia 2,000 years ago, what cosmetics they wore, who did their hair, how much it cost, what eyebrow pencils they used to make themselves appealing. Now, all this makes for a good story, but it, believe me, it doesn't make for a good sermon. I've tried. Now, Mordecai's a hero. But what kind of good Jewish hero would be the guardian of a lovely young thing, his niece, and who would prepare her not for a life as a woman of valor, as a good, upright Jewish lady, but for the life of a courtesan, would prepare her simply to be a favorite in the royal harem for no better reason than her presence there would improve his standing at the court. And what good Jewish uncle would tell his niece to deny their Jewishness, to eat whatever was served from the royal kitchens without demanding kosher food? What good Jewish uncle would send his daughter to a modeling school instead of religious school? And yet that's essentially what Mordecai does. And if the book were a religious book from the times, clearly when the oppression threatens, when Israel is threatened with destruction, someone would get down on his knees and pray, for it is God who delivers according to our tradition. But the word God, the name of God, never once appears in the book of Esther. And when Mordecai and Esther determine to undo Haman, they never appeal to God for help. They simply decide on what will be the most the program, the maneuver, which has the most chance of success. The book appeals to their native shrewdness, to their knowledge of court intrigue. They manage because they are successful, not because God in some way intervenes and delivers the people. The book of Esther is not in the Bible, dear friends, because it's a religious book. It's the book of the Bible because it's a beloved book, it was a good story. Because every community needs a time at the end of the winter, after you've hunkered down in Cleveland during the cold of the winter, when the earth begins to revive, alavai, when the voice of the turtle dove is heard in the land and spring begins to appear. Purim is our Mardi Gras. In every culture, there's been a moment when you cast off the burdens, the gray, the dismal cold, the dank, the gloom. You begin to take off the heavy winter coat and stand up a little taller and begin to think of planting the yard and getting out and enjoying the sunshine again. There's hope. Blood begins to move a little less sluggishly in the body. Your thoughts turn to happier things. That's the mood of Purim. And if you were to ask me why the story of Esther is in the Bible, I'd say that the reason has nothing to do with its contents insofar as the story is concerned, but because of the only dull part of the book, the very concluding chapter, which is nothing more or less than the report of a letter written by Esther and by Mordecai to all the Jews of Persia, enjoining upon them the observance of this holiday. If you remember your history, you'll recall that in the year 722 before the Common Era, the Assyrians came west to the west, conquered Syria, Lebanon, and the northern kingdom of Israel, and took the 10 tribes which comprised the northern kingdom eastward into exile. They became the familiar lost 10 tribes, but actually the leaders simply settled down in what is today Iraq, between the Euphrates and the Tigris River. And about 120 years later, the kingdom of Babylonia, the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, which had overthrown the Assyrian kingdom, sent its armies to the Mediterranean again, overran that part of the world. This time, the southern kingdom of Judah was conquered, and its nobles, its elite, its upper classes were also taken eastward into exile, and they joined the lost 10 tribes in their communities between the Euphrates and the Tigris, and the Babylonian exile begins. Now, this community developed its own history, much as we have our own history here in the United States. It was the first diaspora community. It developed its own history, it developed its own traditions, it developed the synagogue in part. It must have developed its own holidays. And Purim was a holiday which was beloved of this community. We don't know what it represented originally, probably some ancient deliverance, but there it was. And when in the 4th century, the Greeks under Alexander the Great conquered the Middle East, and all of that world now became one kingdom, when all the Jews were now reunited again under one authority, the Judeans wanted to include Purim in the calendar of the festivals of our people. There were some who said, only those festivals which are ordained in the Torah are to be observed. The Judeans wanted to include Purim. And so on the authority of a queen, on the authority of a great prime minister known from legend, on the authority of this letter, they gained the upper hand in the debate, and Purim became part of the annual religious calendar of our people. And the book of Esther is simply a debater's point insofar as it's included in the biblical canon. It is there to authorize carnivals, masquerades, and the springtime festival. I look upon the book, however, in another way, because obviously that's an old bit of history and has no immediate relevance to us. For me, it's a reminder that so much of the living culture of our people is unwritten. It exists in story. It was originally oral. It was not part of the high culture, which became the wisdom literature, the halachic literature, the commandments, the covenant, the prophetic literature. It was part of the folk literature of our people. In the 20th century, historians and cultural anthropologists have reminded us forcefully that the so-called classic literatures of antiquity are only the tip of the iceberg insofar as the understanding of any civilization is concerned. If you read Plato and you read Aristotle, you're reading the literature of a small group of men, a minority of a minority of a community. That small group that was literate, that small group that had the leisure to spend its time in study, walking along the porch or in the academy, discussing the great philosophic themes, only a small proportion of that community could read, could write, could set down its thoughts in writing. These have somehow survived, or some of them have survived, and they used to describe civilization. What they really describe is not Greek civilization, but the civilization of a small Greek elite. I remember when I was in college, everyone was a little puzzled when they discovered that Socrates was not simply the ultimate rationalist, the man who could find a logical argument to raise questions to every assumption made by those who discussed any issue with him, but that Socrates had a little daemon, a little spirit who sat in his ear. And when he couldn't quite understand an argument or define a position which was satisfactory to him, he often heard this spirit speak to him and tell him the truth. Now, where does the daemon come from? The daemon comes from the larger folk culture of Greece, the oral culture which was shared by men, by women, by children. It was a more earthy culture. It was a more robust culture. It was a less erudite culture. It was a culture which was full of superstition, full of mystery, full of magic, full of gods, full of all kinds of things which are colorful and dramatic and full also of some very earthy, good sense, wisdom. What was true in Greece is true equally in ancient Judea. It's true of every culture. 99 and some percentage point of every culture is hidden to us. It survives only orally in the stories that professional storytellers, troubadours, elders, fathers, mothers told to their children. Stories which reveal, if so far as you can, we can rediscover them, which reveal the heart, the living heart of a people. And this culture must be understood if we want to understand any historic people. And the loss of this culture, a loss which is taking place at rapid rate throughout our world today, is one of the great losses for mankind. For one of the things which is happening to all of us is that as the radio is distributed throughout the world, and as the television set follows not far behind, this oral culture, this very special culture, which is Jewish or Greek or Irish or Latin American, disappears. And people are homogenized by a culture which begins in one or two capitals of the world, which represents the attitudes of a few people who have control of these institutions. And so the little spirits and the mother's wisdom and the old wives' tales and all of these things disappear. And we become very much like each other. And there's advantage to that. We can understand each other the better. But there's disadvantage, too. We lose culture. We lose our own identity. And I really worry more about the impact of the media upon Jewish consciousness than I do of the lack of hours that we have with your children in the religious school. Because unless these stories are part of the breath, the living tissue of their lives, something which used to define Jew, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, is lost. And we become largely just simply ciphers replicating one another. The book of Esther is the only book we have in the Bible which comes from this storytelling culture, from the folk wisdom. And when we read it, as we do each year on Purim, we're reminded of where the folk were. And reading the book of Esther one day some 40 years ago, that Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, the first president of the State of Israel and a very fine cultural ethnologist, began a program which has gone largely unrecognized but has been of utmost significance in the saving of our culture. He took the great new machine of the modern world, the tape recorder, and he and his students went out from the Center for the Study of Oriental Jewry in Jerusalem, and they visited in Yemenite homes, they visited in Iranian Jewish homes, they visited in Moroccan Jewish homes. They talked not to the young about the future, but to the old about the past. They turned on the tape recorder, and they asked them to simply regale them with the stories that they heard from their grandparents, from their storytellers, from the Magidim in the past. And these stories are being collected and set down. Now, much is lost, obviously, when the living culture becomes a type culture. But at least we know more now, more than we would have otherwise known, of what it was like from the inside, in the bosom of the family, in the kindergarten classroom, when grandparents talked to grandchildren, on a Saturday afternoon in the shtetl when the Magid came to town and spun out his stories, what these stories were. And we find that the stories are in part familiar, Stories go across cultural lines as easily as books do. But we learned also that they speak of the very specialness of the Jewish culture because they refract Jewish ideas, conventional Jewish wisdom. Usually Socrates is transformed into Isaiah, and Alexander the Great becomes King David. The characters are transposed into familiar people from the Jewish scene. A story or two then, simply chosen at random, from this, the 90% of the iceberg that has generally remained submerged. A tailor and a rabbi. The rabbi wanted a pulpit suit. He was a rather vain rabbi. He wanted to make sure that the pulpit suit would fit exactly. So he went to Warsaw, and he asked who was the best tailor in all of Warsaw. And there were a whole variety of opinions, but he found that there was one little tailor on a small side street who was known as the best workman in cloth in all of Warsaw. So the rabbi went to this tailor, and he said, I need a pulpit suit. I chose some cloth. I'd like it in a week. He came back in a week, and the suit wasn't ready. Come back in another week. He came back the second week, 14 days later. He tried on the suit. Perfect. It fit the rabbi to a T. The rabbi was intrigued also after he bought the suit and paid for it. He said, tell me, my friend, how is it that God created the world in a week? And it took you 2 weeks to make this suit of clothes. The tailor smiled and said, look at yourself. It fits perfectly, doesn't it? And look at the world. There's a story out of Marrakesh. The Jews of North Africa carried the litter with their dead to the cemetery. And there's a phrase in our tradition, tzedakah tatzil mimavet. Tzedakah, charity, redeems from death. It was the custom to give charity at death, and it, in a sense, superstitiously, this sped the soul into heaven. It was a nice way of remembering the dead through a deed that was gracious and helpful. Tzedakah tatzil mimavet. In Arabic, the word taka means a door, a gate, a portal. Now there was in Marrakesh, on the little road that led from the Jewish quarter to the Jewish cemetery, there was a Muslim. And the Muslim saw day after day, except on Shabbos, the procession of the levaya, the accompanying of the dead, as the Jews would bring out their dead for burial in the cemetery. And he would always see that in front of the procession, a man would go forth and say, tzedakah, 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 righteousness, charity, charity, charity. And he heard taka, a gate. And he went to one of his friends, a Jewish businessman, and he said to him, tell me, why do the Jews keep saying taka, 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 gate, 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 as they take their dead to the cemetery? And the businessman didn't want to get involved in the whole issue. He tried to put him off in every way he could. He couldn't. He was importuned. He said, I'll tell you, it's a great religious secret. He said, we know that you Muslims own the keys to heaven. As part of your faith that only Muslims enter paradise. That the archangel Gabriel is the gates of heaven, and only one who has affirmed the Quran and Muhammad can't enter paradise. But we have a secret. Just around the corner from the gate, there's a little hole in the wall, a taka, only big enough for a soul to squeeze through. And we take our corpses to the cemetery, our dead to the cemetery, saying taka, 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 to remind them to use the little hole so that there's a way to get into heaven. Well, this Muslim was a pious man, and he was determined to see that heaven remained a restricted subdivision. So he bought himself all the necessary mason's equipment, the trowel, the cement, the mix, and everything else, and he put it in his coffin, And he plunged a dagger into his heart so that he could get up to heaven and quickly plaster over the taka, the gate. Theology, yes, in a sense. In our tradition, the righteous of all people enter into heaven. Our people were always a minority people. It was not theirs to debate publicly, angrily with the majority about their monopolistic and imperialistic cosmic ideas, but a good story said exactly what they wanted to say. Now, our people had their problems with children growing up just as we do. And they tried to teach some pedagogic lessons, not by courses and parenting and human relationships, but with stories. That's how this oral tradition operates. A father had a prodigal son. He was a no-goodnik, a spoiled, spoiled brat. And the son would not come into the family business. He spent his nights carousing in the coffee houses with the riffraff of the community. He was not above leaving the coffee houses for the houses of ill repute in the city. He had a bad temper. He was spoiled. All of these things the father saw. Now, the father could have done many things. He might angrily have disinherited the boy. He might have lectured him endlessly and been tuned out. Instead of which he bided his time. He heard the son. He didn't pay too much attention to him. The son would keep going out later and later. It was always that. He let it pass. His time to die came. He called his son to him. He said, "My son, you know you've been a disappointment to me. And I know that I've not been able to give you the right kind of guidance. But now that I'm about to die, I'd like to make three requests. They're not hard. I'd like you to agree to them. Well, tell what they are first, and then I'll see if I can agree to them." He said, "Fine. My first request is this. If you go to the coffee houses, don't go before 2 o'clock in the morning." And the son, who'd always fought for the later hours, thought, "Well, that's be easy enough to abide. My father, I'll agree. What's your second request?" "My second request is that if you go to a house of ill repute, you not go there till the cock crows." Well, he wasn't accustomed to going to these places until early in the morning, to the wee hours. That seemed easy enough to abide. "And what's your third request?" "My third request is that when you're angry, you sleep a night on your anger before you act on it." "Certainly, that's easy." The father dies. The son, having some guilt, performs the usual funeral rites, observes the Shiva, and after the week is over, he's ready to begin carousing again, to go back to his old ways. But he's made a promise to his father. And so that first night, when he decides to go to the coffee houses, he can't go till 2 o'clock in the morning, so he goes to sleep. He sets the alarm. He wakes up at 2 o'clock. He goes to the coffee house. He walks in fresh, dressed as he would have been, and he sees his drunken friends. Their mouths are full of mush. They're not making very much sense. They're laughing at things which are not laughable. And he's appalled. For the first time, there's a distance. Instead of joining them, he goes home. A few days later, he decides to visit a lady of easy virtue. And again, he can't go till the cock crows. So he goes to sleep, and he wakes up early in the morning, and he waits for the cock to crow, and finally, the first light of dawn, the cock crows, and he goes to a well-known address, and he knocks on the door, and the woman opens the door, and she's ravaged by the night. And he looks at her. How could he ever have been attracted by this woman whose beauty has been ravaged, who is dissolute and dissipate? He turns around and he goes home. And he goes to work. And he goes into the family business. And he marries. And he has to go on a long journey for trade. And when he comes home a little bit earlier than he'd expected. He comes home and comes in the house, no one expects him, and he hears his wife whispering endearments in the night. And he's flushed with anger. All of his adolescent wrath just, you know, comes to the fore. But he remembers his father's advice, or rather the promise he's made to his father, not to act on his anger, until he slept on it. So he goes back to the caravan and sleeps with the camels till the next morning. The next morning he comes home ready to wreak vengeance upon his unfaithful wife. His mother meets him at the door, and there's a little baby in her arms. And her mother says to her, "This is your child." And he recognizes that his wife was whispering endearments to the baby during the night, that all of his anger was misplaced and mistaken. And presumably, he lived as a mature adult ever after. Which is to say, in the language of the oral tradition, there are more ways than one to raise a child. And if you're lucky and you know a good story and you find it applicable, maybe the advice will work. One more story, then I'm finished. A man had a large flock of goats. And the goats were led by a particular billy goat, a particular large he-goat who was the king of the flock. But the he-goat had a very bad habit. The he-goat every once in a while would wander off for some days and take with him one of the fair milk goats of the flock. And when the billy goat would come back, the milk goat was never with him. After this had happened three or four times, the man told his shepherd's son, "The next time that the billy goat wanders off, I want you to follow him. If he's really a demon, misleading and killing these goats of ours, let's kill him. But perhaps he's taking them someplace else, and we'll be able to get all of the goats that we've lost back." And the boy watches the billy goat, and when the billy goat begins to move, the boy goes following the billy goat, and they go up a long hillside for almost a day. And then the billy goat and the milk goat, who is following him this time, go into a cave in the mountain. And they go deep into the cave, and the boy stumbles along behind, and they go for miles within the cave. And finally he notices at the far end of this cave, a little fissure, a little ray of light. And the billy goat finds a way to go through that little fissure in the rock, and the milk goat follows behind, and the boy is just able to find some way to push his body through. He's slim and young, and when he gets to the other side, he finds himself, lo and behold, in paradise. Green pasture, beautiful trees, birds singing in the air, the sun sparkling just like today. Everything that one has ever imagined paradise to be. And there the billy goat stops and begins to munch on the green grass. And there around him are all the milk goats whom he's brought one by one into this paradisial pasture. And the boy decides that he's got to go back and bring his father. So he goes back to the crack in the wall. But this time, from that side, he can't work his way through. He's caught in paradise, a terrible fate. But he wants his father to join him. How to manage this? Well, the goat obviously goes back and forth. So he writes a note, "My dear father, follow the goat and he'll bring you to paradise." And he ties the note to the back foot of the billy goat. And sure enough, a day or two later, the billy goat goes back through the fissure in the rock, and the boy waits expectantly for his father. The father's back home. He's waiting anxiously for his son. And he sees the billy goat coming alone down the mountainside. And now he's convinced that billy goat is a demon. He's led away the milk goats, and now he's led away his son. He's obviously led them away to destroy them, and in his anger, he takes a knife and he kills the billy goat. And then he discovers the note: "Follow the goat and come to paradise." Where is the hope? It's real, but no one's been there and returned. A simple story, one you don't forget once you've heard it, one a child can understand, theology made simple. There are 1,001 and 1,001 again such stories in the living tradition of our people. These are the stories that the Scroll of Esther reminds us of, a culture, a folk culture, which was rich, full, vibrant, sometimes ridiculous, sometimes excessive, sometimes wise. It made for Jewish life. And if Jewish identity has any meaning, It began here, in the culture of the people. And if the book, reading of the book of Esther on Purim has any meaning for us, it reminds us that our homes have to have some element which is alive and full of action and story and excitement and rich, which we tell and participate in with our children. There has to be a folk Jewish tradition for the Jewish spirit, for the Jewish soul to survive. So have a good Purim, tell a good story, come and bring your grandchildren this afternoon and your children, and let them enjoy being Esther and Haman and Mordecai and Vashti and all of the other wonderful figures from that tradition. And don't be too serious with them today. But help them understand that there's something alive and bright and full of beauty, a good story or two. It's only from the past of your own family, but tell it to them and let them enjoy it. Amen.